is our third and last day of oral argument for the March calendar. I want to welcome Waukesha South High School students who are with us today. They are part of our Court with Class program that the Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin run. And this is a national award-winning program, and we won two national awards. For the students know this, but those present in the courtroom who are not students, I'm telling you that the students have received information about the case you're about to present. They will listen to the oral argument, and at noon they will meet with Justice Steinmetz, who will discuss the procedures of the court and answer questions. Anyone who wishes to attend that noon session is welcome. I would like the Waukesha South High School students to please stand so we can see you, meet you, and greet you. Thank you very much. I hope that you have an informative and interesting hour. Please be seated. Now that we've met you, I would like to introduce the court to you. On my far right is Justice Patrick Crooks. Seated to his left is Justice John Wilcox. To my immediate right is Justice Donald Steinmetz. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice William Babish. To his left, Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. And to her left, Justice David Prosser. One other item of business, the Waukesha South High School students will be joined at noon by the Berlin High School students and Faith Christian School students. And they will all meet with Justice Steinmetz. So I will now call the first case, 97-1414, Joel James Johnson versus James R. Blackburn. Elizabeth V. Pavlik will represent James R. Blackburn. You are shown for 25 minutes. The other two attorneys will split their time, and then you will have rebuttal time. Counsel?
May it please the court, I am Elizabeth Pavlik from Fond du Lac, and I represent the defendants James and Elaine Blackburn and also Germantown Mutual Insurance Company. As I see this case, the important thing is, can landlords be made liable to those who, like the plaintiffs, unbeknownst to the landlords, become occupants of a portion of the landlord's property that is not intended to be occupied? A portion that is not up to code for occupancy.
Excuse me, Ms. Pellet, my ears are getting bad in my older age. If you could just raise the platform up a little bit, there's a button right by your left hand where your left hand was.
On top.
On top.
That's
That'll
it.
Get the speaker a little bit closer to you.
Okay. I'm too tall. You think that's enough?
Newfangled device.
Pardon?
A newfangled device.
It's amazing. Okay, the question is, can landlords be made liable to those who, like the plaintiffs, unbeknownst to the landlords, become occupants of a portion of the landlord's property that is not intended to be occupied, a portion that is not up to code for occupancy, a portion that is not safe for occupants? If Wisconsin law allows such liability to arise, how can the landlord protect against that exposure? We do not argue that the plaintiffs did not have permission to live in the basement. We maintain that the permission did not count because the tenants who gave the permission had no right or authority to give it.
They had no right or authority to what?
To give it.
To give
the permission. I want to be sure that you all understand what the basement was like. It was one room, 13 feet by 25 feet. It had two windows, one at the east end, one at the west end, and they were 17 and a half inches high and about 26 inches wide. The west window was where the dryer was vented. The east window, neither window was openable, and the east window is the one that Mrs. Mullins had to smash to get in and out at the time of the fire. It was a 100-year-old basement. The floor was cement, cracked, damp. It was entirely suitable for the furnace, water heaters, washing machines, dryers, and storage. But it was entirely unsuitable for living quarters for anyone. By allowing people to live in the basement, the tenants were violating not only the law and the landlord's rights, but also every shred of common sense responsible grown-ups are supposed to possess. There was a real and legal distinction between the tenants' rights with regard to their apartment and their rights with regard to the basement. One clear indication is Wisconsin Statute Section 704.05 sub 2, as well as the lease itself. Pursuant to both the lease and the statute, the landlord would have needed the Mullins' authorization to enter the lower apartment for non-emergency maintenance. The landlord would not have needed the Mullins' authorization to enter the basement for any other purpose whatsoever. Also, furnace, water heater, service people, and utility meter readers could come into the basement without the Mullins' permission. The lack of authority Mullins had to allow people to live in the basement was comparable to the authority or the lack of authority that the upstairs tenant, Mr. Plyum, had, or the various service people and meter readers. They all had limited rights to enter, work in, or use the basement. None of them had the right to permit people to live there.
They had a right to be there, though, didn't they? The Mullins had a right.
By be there, do you mean to go into the basement?
To physically be present in the basement.
Right.
Can
yes.
they give that right as tenants to their guests, the right to be physically present in the basement?
I suppose if a grandchild were going downstairs to with the grandma to do the wash, of course.
So what... If you indicate that they can be there in some capacity, not as trespassers, where do you draw the line?
Draw the line with the fact that they moved in. They lived there, in the basement.
If they had been in the apartment but played most of the day in the basement, used it as a rec room. Any problem with that?
Well, we have to change the facts, don't we? There was no rec room. There was a basement room with two furnaces, two water heaters, washer, dryer.
I know. But that's one of the things we do to test the premises to change the facts. So let me try.
All right.
That is that during 6 hours of the day, the kids were downstairs. Kind of give them some space and keep them out of the upstairs. Heaven knows that was full. Any problem with that? Having your kids down there 6 hours a day?
Are the kids 4 and 2 years old, unsupervised?
Sure.
There's a problem. But
well,
no, they would not.
I'm talking about legally.
They would not have been trespassers if they went down there to play.
If they were there 6 hours at night, are they trespassers?
Going down there to play for 6 hours at night?
No, to sleep 6 hours a day.
Yes. I think so.
If they normally lived in the first floor unit, but they have a little camp out, you know, they got their sleeping bags and they put a table up and a little sheet over the table and pretended like they were far away for 8 hours one night, are they trespassers?
Probably.
If they did that during the day for 8 hours, are they trespassers? And played as though it were a tent?
Probably not.
But so what makes the difference between night and day if you got them there 8 hours?
Well, sleeping quarters are different, and there are separate rules which apply to basement sleeping quarters. They have to have an exit, for one thing.
What time did this fire break out?
About 8:30.
P.M. or A.M.?
P.M.
Kids were playing downstairs at the time?
No, they were sleeping. They had been put to bed.
Could I ask, the tenants did not inform the landlord that the extra people were in the apartment. If they had said, my daughter and her children are going to be living with us for a while, and two of them will be sleeping in the basement. What would the response have been?
The response would have been that's illegal, you can't do it. That violates the housing code of La Panne.
Why?
Because there was no second exit, for one thing. There was just the basement stairway and those two very small, very high windows that I've described. And that's against the code.
Ms. Pavlik, are you still arguing, given the holdover of 3 or 4 days, you seem not to be arguing that today?
That's correct. That was if they were guests, Your Honor. These people were not guests, and that's been, I think, admitted by the plaintiffs also. These people had moved in, had their telephone line brought in, had their cable line brought in. They were living in the basement.
Is there any significance to what I read in terms of the facts, that the upstairs tenant had turned in his key to the basement?
I don't think so. I think the plaintiffs think that's significant, but I don't think so. He had the right to use that basement. It had never been taken away from him, and in his deposition he said he knew he had the right to use a basement.
Why did he turn the key in?
Because he was a bachelor, and he didn't do any wash, and he didn't need it.
So my question would be, and I think Justice Bradley got into this somewhat with her numerous examples, but is there any logical stopping point? You seem to say the stopping point is when they sleep. Well, if they went down there during the middle of the day to lay on a cot and rest, would that be against the code? Just to lay down at, say, between, there's too much noise, go down and sleep where, and listen to the washing machine. Because I mean, seriously, it's a question of how long they're there when they're sleeping.
No, I don't think it's a question of how long they're there.
They never can sleep down there? They never can lay down and nap?
I would say no.
So is that a good way, is it the way to distinguish this case is what, that A, there was no permission, and what they were doing down there was illegal in the sense that they were using it as a sleeping quarter. But I was just trying to imagine if we're there for 45 minutes to take a nap, and the same thing had happened. Or they're there washing clothes, and they're sitting in the chair napping. I mean, and just to follow, would that be some way to distinguish this?
I think that my position that these people were trespassers is not completely hinged on exactly what they were doing in the basement at any given moment. It flows from the idea that they were living, occupying, and a part of the premises that was not intended to be occupied, that wasn't suitable to be occupied.
Well, but see, the argument is that it was occupied in the sense, at least for doing certain things, certainly having the washer down there, someone would be able to wash clothes, and when you're washing clothes, you don't automatically start it. Some people do. I'm not an expert in it, I can tell you that. But you can... maybe many years ago I did it, but you either sit there and watch the washing machine if you doze off, and that's what I guess I'm... But they were doing something beyond what was the capability, and that was an overnight.
No, they were living there.
They were living there, okay.
You said something about the telephone line.
Yes.
Where was the telephone?
Marilyn Smith, the mother of the children, had her own telephone line brought in to that basement when she moved in with her own telephone number and her own listing.
There's a phone line in the basement?
That's correct.
And it was installed by the telephone company?
That's correct. Also, cable TV was brought in. It wasn't run down from the upstairs. It was brought in separately in Marilyn Smith's name for their television in the basement.
So, I mean, they were watching television downstairs?
Well, they had a love seat and a chest and a TV and a double bed and a crib and a twin bed and washer, dryer, furnace, water heater. It was all in that same little area. Plus the kids' toys and the kids' clothes and candles, cigarette lighters. The plaintiff, Johnson, argues that because the lease was silent as to the basement, the Mullins could use it for whatever purpose they wanted. In my reply brief, I told a story about my little nephew running around the yard carrying a storm window because I hadn't told him not to. At least the tenants have the rights that flow from the lease and from Wisconsin law. Tenants do not have unlimited rights to the property they rent. For instance, tenant can't sell the property that the tenant is renting. It doesn't say that in the lease, but they can't do that. The amicus brief identifies the fundamental flaw in the Court of Appeals decision as a failure to recognize the difference between guest visitation within the tenant's rights and the essentially illegal conversion of a common area of the landlord's property into another apartment without the knowledge or consent of the landlord, i.e., trespass. Nothing in the lease or in Chapter 704 of the Wisconsin statutes would grant the tenants the right to allow occupancy of the basement for residential purposes by third parties. This case is an attempt to saddle the landlords with all of the risk and responsibility for a tragic result from the improper and illegal use of their premises to which they never consented and from which they never profited. This is fundamentally unfair. The plaintiffs were trespassers, and the landlords were obliged only to refrain from willfully, wantonly, or recklessly inflicting injury upon them. There are also public policy concerns which should prevent the landlords from facing liability in this case. And it is the specific nature of the occupancy and the improper use of the premises which trigger legitimate public policy concerns in this case. Holding a landlord liable for an accident arising from an occupancy in violation of the lease, and in fact, the conversion of a basement room into a living area, gives rise to legitimate public policy considerations as to whether liability in any event should be allowed. It is important to note there is no allegation in this case that the landlords were in any way responsible for causing the fire. The sole basis for the alleged negligence of the landlord is the placement of a smoke detector at the top of the open basement stairway rather than on the ceiling of the basement. The injuries were incurred precisely because the basement had been converted to a use not authorized either by the law or the landlord. Given the nature of this occupancy, multiple public policy factors are triggered. The injury is too remote from the negligence and too wholly out of proportion to the culpability of the alleged negligent tortfeasor in that the plaintiffs would require the landlords essentially to anticipate an improper use of the premises.
With the condition of the basement as you described it, would there have been a legal requirement for a smoke detector to be down there?
I don't know. You know, the fire chief was there, and he said where the smoke detector was a proper place. And he, in fact, had advised people in those same circumstances to put the smoke detector where it was. It was an open stairway, no walls on either side, and no ceiling. And it was at the top of that where the smoke detector was. It's a distance of about 10 feet from where it would have been if it had been on the ceiling at the base of the stairway.
Does the record reflect any interaction between the fire chief and these particular landlords? I mean, did they consult with this fire chief?
Oh, beforehand?
Yeah.
No. No.
I mean, did they rely on his advice?
No. This was after the fact. The fire chief was there investigating the fire. And at that time, he said...
Do you really dispute that there was not a smoke detector in the basement?
Yes. If we want to say on the basement level, I guess there was not a smoke detector at the basement level.
But
You want to go on with that description?
Yeah.
Talking about not in the basement level, where was this one that's in the condo?
The smoke detector was on the ceiling in the back hall at the top of the basement stairs.
So it was actually on the first level.
Well, that ceiling wasn't the same level as the ceiling on the first floor apartment, but it was above the stairway.
I don't quite understand. Could you describe the stairs and the smoke detector? Could you paint a little bit clearer picture? I don't understand.
The stairway had open space on both sides of it. It was that kind of stairway, an open stairway. Didn't have risers, just steps. There was no ceiling above it. You came out of the basement, and then the next ceiling was the hallway. Is that any clearer?
How many steps were there?
Oh, gosh. 10, maybe?
And when you got to the top step, where were you?
You were in the back hall. You could go outside, or you could turn and go into the apartment. That door into the apartment, by the way, was a lockable door, as was the door to the outside. It was intended for both tenants to be able to use that, and the lower apartment would be secured against entrance because it was a lockable door. Then you had to step up into the first floor apartment.
Was it straight up? Did the stairs curve?
Straight.
Straight up.
And when you got to the top of that stair...
I should have gone back there yesterday and looked.
I'm not going to ask you how many stairs there were, but I do want to follow up to Justice Prosser. And when you got to the top of the steps, you know, the last step, and then you stepped into the hallway, I take it if you wanted to see the smoke detector, you had to look up.
Right.
Ms. Pavlik, is there any evidence in the record that the basement had been occupied by anyone else in the past, that anyone else had lived in that basement in the past?
No, there's nothing that tells us that. We know that the son, Richard, slept down there from the time the Mullins moved in, which was also trespassing as far as I'm concerned, but no one ever knew that. The landlords didn't know that.
But Richard had been there from the very beginning of their...
I believe so. They moved in December, and this fire was in April.
Is there any reasonable duty to inspect the premises? I mean, these leases, and I assume there was a lease, that the landlord has the right to come in and inspect...
Well, it would, I suppose, have to have some reason. The agent of the landlord had rented the premises to the Mullins, and had checked with them that the smoke alarms all worked and had new batteries and all of that. He had given them the lease, but after that he didn't have any reason to inspect. It had only been a period of 4 months.
Well, one of the arguments advanced by your client is we didn't know. Well, can a landlord protect it, hide behind ignorance? If this had been going on for 2 years and they didn't inspect, no problem for your client?
You're not saying this had been going on for two years.
No, again, I'm
told well, that might be a little more unreasonable.
So
if it had been 2 years,
are you saying that if they had been there for 2 years and the landlord had not inspected, that you wouldn't be advancing the argument that you weren't aware of it, so how could you give notice? And
I would be advancing the argument that they had done that without permission. Permission was not sought, and whether it was 4 months or 2 years, permission should have been sought.
I'm a long way removed from the trial court in Milwaukee, but landlords can't just enter a rented premises unless there's an emergency or some type of safety hazard that they become aware of. Is that correct?
That's correct, and that was one of my points, is that the landlord could enter that basement anytime they wanted, for any reason or no reason, but they could not enter the apartment of those people unless an emergency or prior permission. That's absolutely correct, and that's one of the significant differences in the tenant's rights as far as their apartment was concerned and the basement.
Did you just say that the landlord could enter the basement at any time?
Yes.
Oh.
Why? Because it was common space?
Yes, and that's where the furnaces were, the water heaters, the meters, yes.
So I guess that was the point. The point is that it was different than the apartment of the Mullins.
Correct.
So the landlord did not have this, quote, restriction of...
prior notice.
Prior notice.
Right. Or emergency. Correct.
What was the justification for having the smoke detector at the top of the stairs?
I'm sorry, I don't understand the question. The smoke detector, that smoke detector is designed to detect a fire that starts in the basement as the smoke comes up the stairs to alert the people upstairs. And it's important to remember there was also a second floor tenant in this two-apartment building, and he also would have to hear that smoke detector if it were to signal a fire in the basement. That's the purpose of that.
And if I understood from your briefs, the defense for putting the detector at that location was that was what the manufacturer suggested. Is that right?
No.
Am I making it up?
No.
That's wrong.
Yes.
Okay.
The manufacturer, the only suggestion the manufacturer makes is a little diagram that comes with the smoke detector,
right.
And it always shows the smoke detectors on the ceilings of the various levels. Those are the directions from the manufacturer. As I pointed out in my brief, the National Fire Code advises departing from that.
Sorry, I knew something. Sorry,
okay.
Go ahead. That was the, so there is at least one, quote, expert view that you have that says it's in the right spot.
Yes, an expert view, plus the code that allows deviation, and in fact advises deviation from the ceiling in certain circumstances, which is exactly what Fire Chief Lentz's point was in this circumstance.
Well, and I apologize for you for having had to leave for part of your argument. Maybe you did this, but and if so, don't repeat it. I'll listen to the tape. What is the rule of law that you want this court to write in an opinion?
I want the rule of law to be that a tenant has no right to allow occupancy of a portion of the premises that are not leased to that tenant exclusively and are not leased to the tenant for the purpose of occupancy. And I want the rule of law to be that such people are trespassers. And the only duty owed to those people is the duty not to willfully or recklessly harm them.
Oops. Well, then how do you, that rule of law cover the questions that Justice Bradley asked about playing there?
I'm sorry, my red light is on and it distracted me.
Sorry. If I copy down your rule of law correctly, and I may not have, your answer to Justice Bradley was that if the children were playing there, they would not be trespassers. So read me your rule of law again. A tenant has no right to occupy.
To allow the occupancy.
Okay.
And I mean by that, living there.
Okay.
Waking, sleeping, watching TV,
okay.
Daily life in the part of the premises that is not suitable for that or not legal for that or not intended for that purpose. And plus, specifically in this case, that basement was not even exclusively the tenant's. Literally, anybody who wanted to come in there could come in there.
It's the occupancy you define as mean living.
That's right.
And then you
That's
define
right.
this as living because they slept there, even though they spent the rest of the time elsewhere. Okay.
Well, all right, I don't know. They may have eaten there and watched TV there and...
Thank you, counsel. You'll have 5 minutes rebuttal. I show on my schedule 10 minutes for Attorney Donahue and 20 minutes for Mr. Aiken. Attorney Aiken.
That's correct. Okay, please, the court. Can you hear me, okay. My name is Jerry Donahue. I'm an attorney from Fond du Lac from the law firm of Donahue, Sharp & Casper. I represent Joel Johnson, the respondent in this case, and as the Chief Justice mentioned, I'm going to spend 10 minutes dealing with the response to the appeal. A fire occurred on April 26, 1995, in a duplex in Waupun, Wisconsin. One child, Joel Johnson Jr., died as a result of that fire. Another child, Brianna Harkins, was seriously burned as a result of that fire. The death of Joel Johnson and the burns to Brianna Harkins could have been avoided had the defendant landlord properly placed a smoke detector in the basement of the home as required by statute. About 5 months prior to the fire, in December of 1994, Diane Mullins, who was the mother of Marilyn Smith, Diane Mullins, her husband, and her two children, Richard and Peggy Smith, moved into the duplex. That was in December of 1994. They rented the lower unit of the duplex, and a man by the name of Robert Plime rented the upper unit. The home had a basement, which was set up for the use of the tenants. The Mullins signed a lease, and the lease permitted guests to remain on the premises for 14 days. The lease also provided procedures that if there was a breach in a term of the lease, that the tenants were to be given a 5-day notice of the breach and a right to cure. If the tenants did not cure that breach within 5 days, then the landlord could begin eviction proceedings. The lease also provided that the lease was governed by statutes, codes, rules, and ordinances, including Chapter 704 of the Wisconsin statutes and Wisconsin Administrative Code Ag Section 134. There was no reference made whatsoever in the lease to the basement. No mention of it, no restriction, no nothing.
All right, Mr. Donahue, my question would be, you indicated that had there been a smoke detector, we wouldn't have had this tragedy. Question is, as I understand the basement, there was just this one access to it going down the stairway, and then there were the two small windows.
That's correct.
So the natural question would be, well, they would have had more time to get out of these small windows, but they didn't have a door to get out of, did they? But they, in other words, the access was up through the basement stairway, I take it.
Yes, Your Honor. What actually happened here is when the fire occurred on the evening of the fire, and that was approximately at about 8 o'clock, the grandmother, Diane Mullins, was upstairs in the first floor level. She heard her granddaughter, Brianna Harkins, cry. She went downstairs, gave the granddaughter a bottle, and the granddaughter was fine. She went back upstairs to watch TV on the first floor level. About 15 minutes later, she heard her granddaughter cry again, this time in a more frantic manner. She proceeded through the kitchen, started to go down into the basement, and went down the flight of stairs into the basement, got about halfway down the stairs, and could not enter into the basement because the basement was engulfed in smoke. She could not enter the basement because it was engulfed in smoke. The smoke detector was right above her on the first floor level, first floor ceiling. That smoke detector had not sounded. So the time period is critical.
Was the smoke detector in good working condition?
According to our experts, yes, it was. It was functioning. It would have been in good working condition, but it did not sound. When the Mullins moved in, their son Richard, and that was back in December of 1994, Richard moved into the basement immediately, and he occupied the basement as a sleeping quarters in an open and obvious manner. He made no attempt. They didn't know there was any violation of any code. And if you get into the violations of the code, they can be very, very technical violations. The size of the window, the distance between the window and the floor. They can be very, very, very technical. But the Mullins used the basement exclusively from the time they got in there. The upstairs rumor did not use it at all. After the Mullins, Marilyn Smith then moved into the apartment, and Marilyn Smith is the daughter of Diane Mullins. She moved into the apartment on April 8th, 19, 95. She moved in with her three children, and when she moved in, the bedroom assignments changed. My client, Joel Johnson, moved upstairs along with Richard Smith, and he shared an upstairs bedroom with him. On the night of the fire, he just happened to be sleeping down there, napping, whatever, on the night of the fire. He did not use that as a sleeping room. 18 days after these parties moved in, there was a fire, and I just described it to Justice Wilcox. Diane, after she tried to enter the basement but could not because of the snow, or because of the smoke, pardon me, ran outside, broke a window, entered, and managed to save Brianna Harkins' life, but could not find Joel Johnson, who was lying on the floor. He had hidden between a water heater and the furnace, and he died of smoke inhalation in this fire. Your Honors, what the defense is asking here, as the court knows, the trial court granted motion for summary judgment and declared that my client and the other child were trespassers at the time here. What the defendants are asking the court to do is basically turn landlord-tenant law as we know it on its end. They're asking to completely turn the law of landlord tenancy in the state of Wisconsin topsy-turvy. What they are basically saying is that there are perhaps a few violations of a code here. And if there are violations of a code, of a building code, that these legal parties should be declared as trespassers and deprived of all their rights as legal guests to this property. Now, if there is a code violation, the lease provides that these people should be given notice of a code violation and a right to cure. It says nothing about depriving them of their rights and declaring them as trespassers. And that's the central issue here.
But what if the jury believes that the landlord didn't know they were there? How can he give notice to anybody that you shouldn't be doing this?
That hasn't been determined, obviously, yet, because we haven't gone to trial. And my response to that just would be simply that there are a lot of code violations that occur in any lease. I think if we took a survey in the state of Wisconsin, probably 95% of all leases would have some type of code violation. Where do you draw the line that says this is a code violation that transforms a legal guest into an illegal trespasser? Where does that happen? And that's what's happening here. As Justice Bradley pointed out, we could have a situation where somebody could be sleeping in the basement for 2 hours, for 4 hours, playing in the basement. What's to distinguish that? These are code violations. This is not someone being on the premises without permission of the owner. They had at all times permission of the land or of the tenant.
Mr. Donahue, you said violations in the plural. Is there more than one?
No. I'm saying that there are not, and there in fact has not been established by anyone, to my knowledge, that in fact there was not a finding by the trial court that there was a violation of the code. Okay, so this is something that would have to be proved or not proved at the time of trial. But no, the only other violation that has come up was there are too many people or they stayed too long. And I think that counsel is basically withdrawing those arguments. So I think what they're relying on is that this basement was not set up for sleeping. But I would point out, if I can just add one thing, that the code does not prohibit people from sleeping in the basement. People can sleep in the basement. They do it all the time. People set basements up for living quarters all the time. You just have to comply with certain fire regulations. Now, in this case, the landlord didn't even know that the basement was not suited for a sleeping arrangement. It wasn't until the time of trial that he had any awareness of that. So had the landlord even visited, it would be my speculation that he would have walked down and said, what's somebody sleeping here? Well, this is just on a temporary basis, because that, in fact, was the case. There is an affidavit on file from Marilyn Smith that she was just going to be there on a temporary basis. This was not, in my opinion, and I think it's supported by the record, a permanent move.
Okay, well, suppose it was 6 months. That's still temporary? Same rules apply, different rules?
I think the same rules apply when it comes to trespass or not trespass. If the court's aware of Ag Section 134.02, you can have a holdover tenant even though that tenant doesn't pay rent, that tenant under the Ag Code is still considered as a tenant until that person is actually evicted by the sheriff.
Now, when such things as the television in the basement and the telephone and that would go to whether or not this was a temporary or more permanent relationship, occupation?
I think a violation of the lease is a violation of the lease, and whether it's temporary or permanent, I don't know that that's critical. I think this is a major step, though, that the defense is asking the court to take, and that is that there's a finding that these people are trespassers. That's a major, major step. My time is up.
Thank you, counsel. Attorney Aiken.
Good morning. I should probably lower this, but I don't know how.
Hey, you learned something already.
Yeah. It's like getting sun past a rooster, isn't it? I'd like to just emphasize a few points. One is, the defense wants to convert a code section that says you can't have sleeping quarters in a basement without two exits into living there. There is no such code provision that talks about occupying or living or staying or breathing or playing in basements. The violation is having a sleeping quarters down there without two exits. Now, we had one exit and we had some windows, and according to the defense's own brief, one of the windows was big enough. The defense maintains the windows didn't open. I don't find that established in the record. I wasn't at the trial court, but I don't find that established. But I don't know why that would be these kids' problems if the windows don't open, if the landlord doesn't maintain his building. The other problem is that this windowsill was 15 inches too high, according to my calculations. So for 15 inches, the landlord wants these children barred as trespassers. But for some 20 feet that he's wrong on a smoke detector, he wants to skate free. I find that to be an unjust result, not appropriate. So if we focus on sleeping quarters, and not just sleeping, you can have your kids sleep in a basement with one exit, presumably if it's not sleeping quarters. Because that's not what the code addresses. In fact, what the code really does is when the inspectors come in, if you have a closet down there at sleeping quarters, if you don't, they don't, but that's a practical matter. Now, everybody assumes these children were sleeping. But how did the fire get started? How did the fire get started? We didn't get the proof at trial, but one of these little children, there was matches and the ubiquitous Bic lighter, the number one cause of child-started fires in America, those two things. So one of these two kids wasn't sleeping. Plus, there was thick smoke in the basement, and one child, the younger, was found out of the bed. How did that occur? When you're asleep and you start getting too much smoke, you don't wake up. That's the problem. That's why they had smoke detectors. And the other child screamed. So that child was either awakened by smoke, unlikely, or was awake to begin with. I think that's important because it moves in to the other problem I see in the case. The landlord says, this smoke detector is fine where it is. But look at the record closely. Did this smoke detector tell these people that there was a fire in the basement? That's not what occurred. When Grandma came out, she came out because she heard one of the kids scream in the basement. And she came and she couldn't get down the stairs. The smoke was so thick. But yet, smoke alarm, the defense says, is okay. It's okay there. It maybe isn't literally how the code says. That isn't gone off yet. That's why a smoke detector belonged in the basement. And we should be clear that it isn't that we say the smoke detector that was placed there was necessarily wrong. They could have had one there. They just needed the other one in the basement. And I don't know what Mr. Lenz's axe is to grind in this case, but if we talk about before the fact, the defense was kind enough in their appendix 127, Exhibit 8, to put the notice that Fire Chief Lenz gave to all landlords up there. This isn't after the fire, and who knows if he knows this manager and his chummy with him, or he knows the landlord's chummy. This is when he's speaking to everybody. And this is what that notice says. It's to all landlords. Attention, landlords. Smoke detector requirement. One- and two-family dwellings require a smoke detector in the basement and on each floor level. That's what his notice said. It doesn't say in the basement, but you can stick it on a stairway if you feel like it. Then he goes on to...
Excuse me. What does the record reflect with respect to the first floor? There was that smoke detector that was at the landing. Were there any other smoke detectors on the first floor?
I don't know. I wasn't at the trial court level.
Oh, okay.
You'll have to ask Ms. Patrick about that. But in answer to the question indirectly, I'll tell you what his notice said. He says he interprets this in this notice. The smoke detector requirement for multifamily residential buildings is in the basement, that's number one. Two, at the head of every open common stairway, that's number two. That would have been the smoke detector we had. He didn't say in the basement or at the head of the open stairway. He said in the basement, number one. Number two, at the head of every open common stairway. This was an open common stairway. Three, at the door on each floor level leading to every enclosed common stairway. And four, in each sleeping area of the living unit. So if he chose to, according to Fire Chief Lenz in his notice, there should have been a fire detector on the ceiling of the basement, also where this smoke detector was, also in the living compartment. That's what his notice said. And the code is clear. And as we said, if an officer decides to testify that going 70 isn't really speeding, does that mean it isn't a violation of the law? The landlord didn't rely upon this ex post facto testimony. The landlord should have relied upon this notice that told him right where it should be. So all the arguments was, this is a real good place to have a smoke detector because the second floor tenant can hear it. Good. That's what he told people. Put it there. But he also said, put it in the basement. And the proof is in the pudding. The smoke detector didn't alert these people of this fire until it was so late they couldn't even get down the stairway to get to the children. Secondly, I did some research in antiquity because I was wondering about whether or not there was ever such a time when landlords could sue tenants for trespass if they violated terms of the lease. And as close as I came was the Figgies case, F-E-I-G-E-S, versus Restrained Dry Goods, 231 Wis 270. And this is what the case talks about. Back before 1850, there was an action in trespass that a landlord could bring against a tenant, and it included damages. Then it was changed in 1856 or 58 to an action ex delicto, which the court interpreted in this Figgis case was just like an action for trespass. But both of these concepts have been eliminated from our law. In this ex delicto, the landlord would sue the tenant for treble damages for trespass, in essence. We don't have that action anymore. We have a prescribed method. It's called notice of breach, time to cure the breach, start evicting. And it not only is part of the law, it's part of this lease. Now, as was brought out, this landlord's manager lived about a half a mile away. He's getting rent every month. He can come inspect common areas because the utility people are going there. He can go down there and say, I don't like this sleeping arrangement. Not only did our clients not know that the window wasn't low enough, or that maybe they didn't even know you needed two exits, the landlord didn't know it. So now these kids are going to become trespassers because they didn't know about the fire code, which the landlord didn't know. A 15-inch violation if the window would open. Now, the defense says, but they didn't have a right to live in the basement. That simply isn't true. Where does it say they didn't have a right to live in the basement? There is no such provision. There's no such provision in the lease. There's no such provision in the code. Unless you take one part of living, sleeping. Now that part, the code says without this window being 15 inches lower and openable, they shouldn't sleep there. But everything else for daily living they had the right to do. Napping, playing with toys, and unfortunately, playing with matches. So I submit, since there is no strict proof on this record that these children were sleeping, if they were down in that basement playing with matches at the time of this fire, they surely are not trespassers, even if you say a code violation makes them trespassers. But let's change it. Let's have them playing with matches in the back hall, right underneath the smoke detector. They're still in violation, according to the defense, for having a sleeping area in the basement. Are they then barred? They're not down there anymore. Where is the connection?
There's no proof that the failure to have a second doorway meant that these two little young children didn't get out. No, that the truth of the matter is you are allowed to live. You just aren't allowed to have a sleeping quarters. And I think that's an important distinction. And to say that these children become trespassers...
I'm sorry. I can't let that one go by.
Okay.
How can you live and not sleep? I mean, I try it occasionally. It's
well,
not very
I know.
Successful.
It's difficult. What I want to point out is that sleeping is, for some people, somewhere between 25% and a third of their day. There's a whole bunch of other things we do that are living, that include doing wash, playing, watching TV, talking on the telephone, all things that are okay to do in basements, all things that are okay, as we used in our brief, to do in the yard. There's no description of what we're allowed to do in the yard. What if a guest child falls down an unguarded well shaft? That's part of living.
Okay, but, so the code, according to you, says you can't have sleeping quarters. So you can do everything there but sleep.
According to the code, yes. You can build out a basement all over Wisconsin.
And you're saying that, one, you don't know that they were sleeping, so therefore it may not have been sleeping quarters at the time they were there, even though it was set up for them to sleep, right?
No question, it was set up for sleeping and living, sleeping being part of living. I'm just saying that this is a distinction without a difference, because if we focus on the legal argument, that is, a code violation makes them trespassers, it doesn't matter if they were sleeping, it doesn't matter if that fire occurred in the basement, it could have occurred in the first floor bedroom, because the simple fact is it was a code violation.
Are you saying that the argument, if we took the defendant's argument, that no matter where these children were injured, that they would be trespassers because there were sleeping quarters there?
Apparently. Why not?
So you're saying that leads to absurd results?
Pardon?
I mean,
yes.
And that's your argument.
Sure. And it's because they also, in the lower court, made the argument that because they stayed 18 days, they were trespassers. So it didn't matter at the lower court. They realized that argument got absurd and dropped it. But they said, well, they were there 18 days, so they were trespassers then, too. I mean, either a lease violation and a code violation is just that. You get notice, you get a chance to cure. I don't know why there's a chance to cure if all of a sudden you're trespassers on the premises. And then if you don't cure, you get evicted. Either that's the law, which it is, and that's in the lease, which it is, or it doesn't really matter where the code violation occurs and what its connection is, if any, to the injury. Because as soon as you violate a code violation, as soon as you have a code violation, you are a trespasser. As soon as you stayed 14 days, as soon as you set up sleeping quarters in the basement, there's no necessary connection. And that's why I think the questions about sleeping during the middle of the day are noteworthy. You could be down there playing camping. What if one of the gentlemen went down to watch TV because everybody's playing cards and he dozed off watching TV in the basement and it hadn't been a sleeping quarters? Then what? Is he still a trespasser? Well, it's a common area. I mean, the whole argument, and I think that's why the defense keeps trying to take the small umbrella of sleeping and expand it to living, because that's really what the landlord is objecting to.
Mr. Aiken, if I remember, and I'm trying to flip through my notes with all these many briefs, there was an appeal and a cross appeal, right?
True.
Okay. Are you going to talk about both aspects?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
But I'm going to deal with the second aspect briefly, because I think, and I touched on it briefly, that the code is clear that the smoke alarm belongs in the basement and on every floor. Fire Chief Lenz's smoke detector requirement, attention landlord, repeats that requirement and expands it to include in the basement and at the head of every open common stairway, at the door of each floor level leading to every enclosed common stairway, and in each sleeping area. So according to what he told landlords, you needed it in the basement, where it was, and in the sleeping quarters in both units.
So what does that do to it? What's the legal issue that we're going to do?
The legal issue is whether or not this failure to have a smoke detector in the basement is a violation of the statute, because that's how the statute reads. There is no ambiguity. And if so, is that negligence per se? Now, the Court of Appeals held it was negligence per se. The defense has not appealed that, and I'm ready to discuss if the court wants. My only comment there is that the defense and us agreed that this liability theory is not a requirement in the Court of Appeals, but the Court of Appeals keeps inserting a separate legal claim theory into negligence per se. I don't think it belongs there, but I don't know if the court wants that addressed or not. There's a difference between negligence per se and public liability. Public liability is like the swine flu. You don't have to show negligence. It's nothing about negligence. It's public liability. Negligence per se is you have a statute that if it's violated, you can either introduce as proof of negligence or it is negligence in and of itself, the failure to have two airbags in the front seat. You don't need to establish the legislature wanted to give you a private cause of action to have negligence per se. But as I said, the defense in its reply brief in the Court of Appeals agreed that that wasn't part of it, but the Court of Appeals insists on throwing that in. But I think this is very clearly a safety statute. These are the type of people that are meant to be protected. And I just can't even imagine why one would want to take a statute that says in the basement and at every floor level and say that it counts when it's at the floor level but when it's on the basement, because a fire chief after the fact says that ain't so. But before the fact, he said it was so.
Mr. Aiken,
yes, sir.
I wonder if we could go back for a minute to the first issue, the trespasser issue.
Yes, sir.
Are you saying that there are genuine issues of material fact on that issue, and therefore summary judgment should not have been granted?
I'm saying summary judgment shouldn't have been granted because they're not trespassers as a matter of law.
So you're not arguing genuine issues of material fact?
I think that if this court decides that if they were sleeping or not to determine if they were trespassers, that would be a question of fact. I say that's really immaterial. If the court argues whether or not the code violation has to be severe or not, as far as the height of the window goes, that would make them trespassers or not, then it would be material fact. I say that's immaterial. If the court says it depends if we can show that the landlord or his agent knew or should have known they were in the basement, that would be a question of material fact. I say that's immaterial because the simple fact is we have a statute that says he has a right to come into common areas. If he didn't know, he should have known. If he wanted to protest, he should have given his notice, and we could have cured the problem. None of those things make these children trespassers, my position. But at the very best, there are things that the court could say, well, some of these things might be important to us. I don't think that would be wise because I think that's against the statutes, and that's why I cited this case of antiquity. The action for trespass against a tenant is gone. Doesn't exist anymore. And this is really a backdoor attempt to get an action for trespass by making the tenants and therefore their guests be trespassers to bar their claims. That's my essential position.
Could the Blackburns have given permission for the family to live in the basement and sleep there?
They could have with this proviso. Provide a stoop to that window and make sure the window opens. One of the windows was big enough. That's all that had to be done. At least that's how I read it. I could be wrong. But the answer to the question is, if you're willing to modify the basement in some way, okay, the sill has to be 46, and I think the defense brief says that it was 61, and it has to be a certain size. One window wasn't, but the other was.
I thought opposing counsel indicated that you would need some doorways also. Are you saying
that
you don't need doors?
You got one. You have one doorway, a window suffices for your second exit point. But it has to be at a level of 46 inches, which I was trying to point out before. I don't think the age of these children, one was four, a 46-inch window exit is going to do these kids a lot of good. But that fulfills the code. I mean, 46 inches, my goodness, that's like this high. I mean, what good is that going to do a child who isn't even 46 inches tall? But that's what the code provides. And that's why I emphasize the sleeping quarters concept, because in my own experience, if you have an area downstairs that may be used for sleeping, as long as you don't have a closet in there, nothing happens. But what you need to do is get a second exit point that can be reasonably used, and that wasn't available here for apparently a number of reasons, one of which the windows apparently didn't open, although when the defense stated that in their brief, there was no citation to any authority, but I believe that it was probably a good faith representation, but I'm not aware of that fact. I'm not aware that that fact has been proved, that the windows weren't openable. Maybe there needed to be an adjustment. But, of course, the problem is that nobody, landlord or tenant, knew that this wasn't allowed.
Counsel, you make the argument that a code violation does not transform someone into a trespasser. Your opposing counsel makes an argument that, look, landlord didn't know. I mean, how should they be liable for people that were sleeping there illegally, beyond the terms of the lease, beyond what's allowed under the code? And there's something compelling to that. What about the public policy response, if any, in terms of landlord shouldn't be held liable for this kind of injury because it didn't know about it and reasonably couldn't know about it?
The landlord isn't being called into question for anything more than something he should have done before he leased this premises. Anything that occurred thereafter, he's not being called into question on. And that is, he should have put a smoke detector where it belonged, on the basement ceiling, and prevented the harm to these little children. It isn't unfair that anything that, all this stuff that happened elsewhere is an excuse by trying to bar the children on the basis of trespassers. The simple fact is that if he had done what he was supposed to do, he couldn't be called into question. He isn't being blamed for letting the children sleep in the basement. He isn't being blamed for not inspecting. He isn't being blamed for having a cable TV thing down there. He's being blamed because he didn't put a smoke detector where it belonged before he leased the premises. And that is generally the law of landlord-tenant anyway, that landlords are blamed for things that existed when they handed over the premises. So what difference does the other things make as the days go on, as long as they don't affect his smoke detector that wasn't there? That's why I don't think it's unfair. He didn't conform with the law.
Mr. Aiken, I'm sorry. I'm looking at the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals held, as I see it, that as a matter of law, they were not trespassers.
True.
And therefore, a duty of reasonable care. Now, if the Court of Appeals would be affirmed, I would assume that this case goes back for trial as to what the duty of care was and whether it's been breached. And they found that 101-645 is a safety statute, so that I assume that would be negligence per se, if there was a violation.
True.
And then, what would go back for trial is to determine whether there's a violation, right?
If the words in the basement mean in the basement, true.
Okay. The other issues that would be tried would be causation and damages, is that right?
True.
Anything else?
Not that I can think of.
Okay. And your position is that you want us to affirm the question of law and trespassers?
True.
And your position is, I assume, that you want us to affirm that 101-645 is a safety statute?
True, especially since that wasn't appealed.
And then I assume that in your answer to Justice Crook's question, you differ from the Court of Appeals because you think there's no material issue of disputed facts.